Amen. Thank you, guys. Take your Bibles and let us turn to Ezekiel chapter 41 and 42. Ezekiel chapter 41. Actually, we're going to start at 40. We got to review just a bit. Ezekiel chapter 40, and I'll tell you what, I'll go ahead and read verses 1 through 4. And then we're going to get a little bit of review session and then cover some new stuff beginning at the end of chapter 40, running through 41, and actually all of 42. So we got lots to cover this morning. So Ezekiel chapter 40, let me go ahead and read those first four verses. In the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th of the month, in the 14th year after the fall of the city, on that very day the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he took me there. In visions of God he took me to the land of Israel, and set me on a very high mountain, on whose south side were some buildings that looked like a city. He took me there, and I saw a man whose appearance was like bronze. He was standing in the gateway with a linen cord and a measuring rod in his hand. The man said to me, "Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears and pay attention to everything I am going to show you, for that is why you have been brought here. Tell the house of Israel everything that you see." Let's pray. Lord, we are indeed grateful to be here this morning, and we're thankful for your presence with us, your ministry to us already in so many ways. And we ask that as we come before your word, that you would indeed speak to us. And that you'd give us ears to hear you. May our hearts be receptive. May we be mindful to obey you. We pray that through your word, you would change us for your glory. We ask you to be with all of our children and our children's workers as well, that you would anoint their time together. May we be all drawn deeper into your presence. In Jesus' name we ask. Amen. So some of you, a few of you weren't here last week. And you may be glad by the time we're done. But what we are working with today is basically Ezekiel's vision of this temple. And it's important to kind of quickly note the time. It's 25 years after Jehoiakim was taken into captivity. Jehoiakim was the king of Israel that the Babylonians took captive, and they put up another king. His name was Zedekiah. You may or may not recall that Ezekiel was taken captive with Jehoiakim, and he was about 25 years old when he was taken captive. He receives his first vision of God when he's in the fifth year of captivity, about age 30. And the interesting thing about that is that Ezekiel was of priestly lineage. He was preparing to be a priest, 25 years age. He would be thinking, I have 5 years to go to kind of be ready to take on my responsibilities as a priest in the temple. And he would have been hoping that he would have been able to go back home to Babylon and to take up that responsibility. Again, Babylon had not yet destroyed Jerusalem. Everybody thought Jerusalem was safe, was saved. He had hopes of returning to the temple. But at age 30, when he would have begun his service in the temple, the Lord begins to speak to him, to show him visions, and the news that he gets is that the temple is going to be destroyed, and that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed, and that the people are going to be taken captive, that they have so defiled God's name, so profaned God's name, that God was going to take everything apart. So he has been announcing for chapter upon chapter. We've been covering it week upon week. But there were 24 chapters of judgment. And then he had some more judgment chapters in terms of words to the nations, that God would judge them as well. And then back around Thanksgiving, we started to kind of turn a corner back in early November to where now all of a sudden we started to get messages of restoration. That Jerusalem had fallen, the temple had been destroyed, the king had been put to death. King Jehoiakim, he was still in captivity in Babylon. Ezekiel's still in captivity, and they have a whole lot of company now of Jews who had been taken captive. And so we're now 25 years past when Ezekiel was taken captive. And we are now 20 years past when he received his first vision. And so he's 50 years old now. So got that first vision of destruction when he was age 30. and now he gets this vision at age 50. And again, just kind of interesting that at age 50, that's when his time of service would have been completed. That he would have served the Lord in the temple from age 30 to age 50. He's 50 years old now. He never got to do that service. The temple was destroyed. And he gets this vision. And it's a vision of a temple that is new and of a temple that is built already, and it's in the land of Israel. And so it's amazing that he gets this vision. These are not instructions, hey, go build this temple. This is a vision of something that already is. Now, obviously, it wasn't physically there. And when they get back, they are not able to physically build this temple. They do go back, they do rebuild the temple, but it's not a temple that looks like this temple. It doesn't come close. But he sees this vision, and he's given a tour of it. And so the best way I know how to think about that is that he is being given a vision of what we might call a theological reality. That temple is real, that God is reestablishing God's presence there on that mountain in the land of Israel. And so even though there's no physical building that matches up with it, at the same time, you cannot mistake kind of the reality that's there. And some would say it's a reality that's going to come, that's going to eventually be embodied. That may be so hard to say. But that doesn't, whether it actually ever gets built or not, that doesn't make it any less real in terms of the truth that's being communicated by the vision. And so that's what I want us to kind of think through as we work through the architecture here, as we begin to see or hear about what was shown to Ezekiel, that there is truth in the architecture. And so the truth in what he has shown, that's what we want to try to pick up on. And so if you were here last week, you'll recognize some of these slides. That helped a lot. But Rodney, go ahead and move through them. First thing we saw is that there was a wall that went around kind of the whole temple compound, and it was 10 feet high and 10 feet deep. Actually, it was a rod. By the way, just your measurements. We're going to read through this. So a cubit is how long, those of you who are here? From the elbow to the tip of the finger, roughly a foot and a half. But remember, these were Papa-sized cubits. So instead of being a foot and a half, it was roughly, 21 inches, something like that. And so he's a rod equals 6 cubits. And so a rod is about 10 feet. And so we got these kind of 6 cubit or rod measurements. And then he has a linen cord, but he never uses that, just kind of carries it around. So anyways, we have the outer wall that's 10 feet by 10 feet. And then we also notice that there were huge gates in the wall. And so the purpose of the wall was not to keep people out, per se. It organized the space and these huge gates so that lots of people could pass in and pass out of the temple area. Go ahead and keep going. There's more of the gate structure. Notice here that we have these kind of, we might call them bungalows, that are kind of around the whole perimeter of the temple campus, temple complex. That's where you would share meals together. That when you and your family, you and your friends went to the temple and you would go to the sacrifices would be offered in the center of the temple. The prayers were made in the center of the temple. But you would have a time of fellowship with your friends, with your family, with your neighbors that you went to the temple with. And so these bungalows or these rooms on the outside of the temple, those are basically dining halls. Those are meeting rooms. And so there would be this fellowship at the temple where you would talk about how God has blessed you and been good to you. We also see kind of at the center of the temple some more gates, and kind of the focus today is going to be more on what's at the center of the temple. And of course, you see the spacing, the 100 cubits, all of that stuff. Okay, so Rodney, go ahead and shut that down and go to chapter 41. Chapter 41. I think you'll see some slides there. Yeah, just close that whole box. And I think it's top right-hand corner. Oh, that's the movie version. Okay, you guys want to see the movie version? All right. top right hand. We'll watch that at halftime. Okay, go ahead and hit that first one. Okay, so let me back up. I'm going to read a little bit of stuff. Just keep that one there. So where I'm reading from is chapter 40 and verse 40, and now we get into the temple proper, and I'll better explain this and try to help visualize this as we go. So this bronze man, he brought me to the portico of the temple and measured the jambs of the portico. They were 5 cubits wide on either side. The width of the entrance was 14 cubits, and its projecting walls there, 3 cubits wide on either side. The portico was 20 cubits wide and 12 cubits from front to back. It was reached by a flight of stairs, and there were pillars on each side of the jambs. Then the man brought me to the outer sanctuary and measured the jambs. The width of the jambs were 6 cubits on each side. The entrance was 10 cubits wide, and the projecting walls on each side of it were 5 cubits wide. He also measured the outer sanctuary. It was 40 cubits long and 20 cubits wide. Then he went into the inner sanctuary and measured the jambs to the of the entrance. Each was 2 cubits wide. The entrance was 6 cubits wide, and the projecting walls on each side of it were 7 cubits wide. And he measured the length of the inner sanctuary. It was 20 cubits, and its width was 20 cubits across the end of the outer sanctuary. He said to me, "This is the most holy place." Okay, so here you have kind of a picture of this entrance into the portico, and then from the portico we're going to make it into kind of what's referred to as the outer temple. Notice it's 20 cubits wide, 40 cubits deep, and then one more. There's the entrance now from the outer sanctuary into the inner sanctuary. And now we are into the inner sanctuary. Go ahead, back up one slide. And it is a perfectly square room. 20 cubits by 20 cubits. By the way, how long is 20 cubits? Let's go regular cubit. Dan?
Foot and a half.
Foot and a half, so 20 of those would be?
30
feet. And then if you popsize it, maybe it's about 34, 35 feet. Okay, so the inner sanctuary would be roughly 35 feet by 35 feet. And to kind of help you gauge that, our sanctuary is about 30 feet or so across. So you could think of a room about this size square, and they don't give us the upper dimension, but it's probably just as high as it is wide and deep. Okay, so that would be, and we get the word there that this is the most holy place. So Ronnie, if you could go one more slide forward. This is what So this is the closest thing I get to playing to actually using a drumstick. So that would be what we just described. Okay, so that would be looking at it from the top. Now go ahead, Rodney, one more slide. And there you would have it. So this would be, this area here is kind of the portico. This is where you would enter, kind of the foyer. And then we have this sanctuary here. Kind of a main meeting hall, if you want to think of it that way. And actually, in Hebrew, the term would be literally the big house. And so this is kind of the big house, and then this is the inner sanctuary. This is referred to as the Holy of Holies. Okay, so that's what's being described there. We'll talk more about that in a moment. We'll go ahead and keep reading. So now I'm at verse 5 in chapter 41. Then he measured the wall of the temple, and it was 6 cubits thick, and each side room around the temple was 4 cubits wide. The side rooms were on 3 levels, one above another, 30 on each level. There were ledges all around the wall of the temple to serve as supports for the side rooms, so that the supports were not inserted into the wall of the temple. The side rooms all around the temple were wider at each successive level. The structure surrounding the temple was built in ascending stages so that the rooms widened as one went upward. A stairway went up from the lowest floor to the top floor through the middle floor. I saw that the temple had a raised base all around it, forming the foundation of the side rooms. It was a length of the rod 6 long cubits. The outer wall of the side rooms was 5 cubits thick. The open area between the side rooms of the temple and the priest's rooms were 20 cubits wide all around the temple. There were entrances to the side rooms from the open area, one on the north and another on the south. and the base adjoining the open area was 5 cubits wide all around. Okay, so Rodney, go ahead and go another slide. Let's see. Okay, so what we're beginning to see, go ahead, go another one. Keep going. Okay, back up one slide, sorry. Okay, so here's the main structure, the main temple, and then what's being shown is that we have these rooms that are kind of along the perimeter on the sides of the temple. And we think that those rooms, it's never said in the scripture what those rooms are used for, but the general consensus is that those were probably storage rooms. That when people would bring their grain offerings, they would bring various kind of offerings or whatever things that the priest might have, things that were donated, whatnot, that those were kind of the treasury rooms. And so lots of kind of storage space, treasury space there. So we think that's what goes on there. Okay, let me keep going. Next slide. Let's see, where are we? Okay, go on to where you get to 12. Okay. On the back side of the temple was this huge room. Verse 12. The building facing the temple courtyard on the west side was 70 cubits wide. The wall of the building was 5 cubits thick all around, and its length was 90 cubits. Then he measured the temple. It was 100 cubits long, and the temple courtyard and the building with its walls were also 100 cubits long. The width of the temple courtyard on the east, including the front of the temple, was 100 cubits. Then he measured the length of the building facing the courtyard at the rear of the temple, including its galleries on each side. It was 100 cubits. So there is this huge room on the back of the temple. Here we go. And it's huge. And that's all we hear about it. Just a big room back there. And doesn't tell us anything. He never gets to go inside that room. So he's able to actually, he doesn't go into the Holy of Holies. He's able to see through the door of the Holy of Holies as the bronze man is measuring it off. But he doesn't go in there. But this back building, he doesn't get to look into it. So it's back there. It's huge. But he never gets to see inside of it. Doesn't go there. And then everything is kind of measured off, and we see that everything is kind of turns into kind of these perfect dimensions, perfect square. Okay, let me keep on going, and then trust me, we're going to pull all this stuff together. So where am I? Let's see, middle of verse 15 in chapter 41. The outer sanctuary, the inner sanctuary, and the portico facing the court, as well as the thresholds and the narrow windows and galleries around the three of them, everything beyond and including the threshold was covered with wood. The floor, the wall up to the windows, and the windows were covered. In the space above the outside of the entrance to the inner sanctuary and on the walls at regular intervals all around the inner and outer sanctuary were carved cherubim and palm trees. Palm trees alternated with cherubim. Each cherub had two faces, the face of a man toward the palm tree on one side and the face of a lion toward the palm tree on the other. They were carved all around the whole temple. From the floor to the area above the entrance, cherubim and palm trees were carved on the wall of the outer sanctuary. Okay, so I think you can kind of see it, but just imagine these kind of cherubim, angel-like figures, and they have a face kind of pointing in each direction. And so one face is animal, one face is lion, one face is human, and then palm trees in between them, kind of all the way around on this wood paneling. Verse 21. The outer sanctuary had a rectangular door frame, and the one at the front of the most holy place was similar. There was a wooden altar 3 cubits high and 2 cubits square. Its corners, its base, and its sides were of wood. The man said to me, "This is the table that is before the Lord." Both the outer sanctuary and the most holy place had double doors. Each door had two hinge leaves for each door. And on the doors of the outer sanctuary were carved cherubim and palm trees like those carved on the walls. And there was a wooden overhang on the front of the portico. On the side walls of the portico were narrow windows with palm trees carved on each side. The side rooms of the temple also had overhangs. Okay, and so you're kind of starting to see that. There would be this table that's in the sanctuary that would be kind of in the prime, in the, not the, not the inner sanctuary, but the outer sanctuary. Okay, I'm going to read chapter 42. I'm sorry, I don't have slides for chapter 42, but I think you'll be able to survive. Then the man led me northward into the outer court and brought me to the rooms opposite the temple courtyard and opposite the wall on the north side. The building whose door faced north was 100 cubits long and 50 cubits wide, both in the section 20 cubits from the inner court and in the section opposite the pavement of the outer court, gallery faced gallery at the three levels. In front of the rooms was an inner passageway 10 cubits wide and 100 cubits long. Their doors were on the north. Now the upper rooms were narrower, for the galleries took more space from them than from the rooms on the lower and middle floors of the building. The rooms on the third floor had no pillars, as the courts had, so they were smaller in floor space than those over the lower and middle floors. There was an outer wall parallel to the rooms in the outer court. It extended in front of the rooms for 50 cubits. While the row of rooms on the side next to the outer court was 50 cubits long, the row on the side nearest the sanctuary was 100 cubits long. The lower rooms had an entrance on the east side as one enters them from the outer court. On the south side, along the length of the wall of the outer court, adjoining the temple courtyard and opposite the outer wall, were rooms with a passageway in front of them. These were like the rooms of the north. They had the same length and width with similar exits and dimensions. Similar to the doors on the north were the doorways of the rooms on the south. There was a doorway at the beginning of the passageway that was parallel to the corresponding wall extending eastward by which one enters the rooms. And we will look at a slide that kind of calls attention to this. Then he said to me, "The north and south rooms facing the temple courtyard are the priest rooms, where the priests who approach the Lord will eat the most holy offerings. There they will put the most holy offerings, the grain offerings, the sin offerings, and the guilt offerings, for the place is holy. Once the priests enter the holy precincts, they are not to go into the outer court until they leave behind the garments in which they minister, for these are holy. They are to put on other clothes before they go near the place that are for the people." When he had finished measuring what was inside the temple area, he led me out by the east gate and measured the area all around. He measured the east side with the measuring rod. It was 500 cubits. He measured the north side. It was 500 cubits by the measuring rod. He measured the south side. It was 500 cubits by the measuring rod. And he turned to the west side and measured. It was 500 cubits by the measuring rod. So he measured the area on all four sides. It had a wall around it, 500 cubits long and 500 cubits wide, to separate the holy from the common. Okay, so Rodney, if you could, let's go ahead and find a slide that is kind of the whole complex. And so that might be better to go back to chapter 40. I think they had some slides in there that were of the whole thing. Let's see. Yes. Okay, so we're going to talk about different places of it and try to think about, okay, what's the truth that's in the architecture, what's being conveyed. And so the first thing I want to call attention to is this area here. Okay, and so this would be the sanctuary or the temple proper. Remember, we had the vestibule, kind of the entranceway or portico, I think it was called. And then in here we have the 20 cubit, it's all 20 cubits wide. And then we had the 40 cubit kind of sanctuary. And then we had back here the 20 by 20 cubit, the Holy of Holies. And then we have kind of this big house. Well, this is the big house, but then we have this building back here that he doesn't get to see. The entryways. The entryways get progressively smaller as you go to the back. So I think we start out with this front wall. It's 20 cubits wide, and the front door is 14 cubits out of the 20. So begin to imagine, 20 cubits wide. How long was that, Dan?
34
feet wide, because they were Papa size cubits. And then the entryway of that 20 cubit wall is 14 cubits. So it's a huge entrance. And then we're going to move from 14 cubits here to 12 cubits wide. And eventually I think we got down to 8 cubits wide for the Holy of Holies. And so it gets narrower and narrower, and it's kind of understood that this is the house. That this is the house where you meet God, that this is the Holy of Holies, that God actually dwells there. And in fact, the back room that is kind of disconnected from the temple, but part of the complex that's so huge in the back, it makes the whole thing kind of resemble more of a palace rather than what we might think of as simply a temple. And this is what I think is significant about it. This, I think, is kind of the truth of the architecture, if I can say it this way, is that when I begin to think about this as big house or palace over against what I sometimes think of as temple, God really dwells there. I mean, that's what's being communicated, is that God actually resides here. I think sometimes we think about the temple more like we think about an office. That for the most part, nobody really lives at their office. I think sometimes Vonda does, but that's just in busy seasons. Okay, but for the most part, we don't live at our offices. We live at our homes. We go to our offices for meetings, for work, but we leave, we go back home. And sometimes I think that that's how we see the temple, that it's just kind of an office spot for God. And so you go to the office and you leave, but you don't think God really lives at the office. You might catch God at the office on a good day, but in general, you don't expect God to be at the office, or maybe God keeps a good schedule. He's got good office hours. But that is way different than beginning to think about the temple as actually God's house. Now, our district superintendent, he has a house in Apple Valley where his wife lives and where he moved from. He has a trailer that he stays in, and then he'll show up to the office at times. Okay, but the office is kind of impersonal. It's not his dwelling place. And so what's being communicated here is that the temple really is God's residence. He resides there. He dwells there. Not just a place that he shows up for business and you might catch him. Like any house, there are places where you are welcome and places where maybe you're not as welcome. So I'll just warn you today, if you come to my house, don't go upstairs. You're not welcome there. Okay, you're welcome to come and stay downstairs, make use of pretty much everything downstairs except the garage. But there are places where you are wide open welcome, and then there are other places where, you know, only our children can come. And then there are places where we're not sure we even want the children there. You know, kind of, that's just how houses are. You have receptive areas, but then you have areas that are kind of more personal, kind of more intimate. And so that's what's going on with the temple structure. And so you have this wide open compound, this wide open campus with these huge gates where everybody is welcome. But as you move closer to the center, then there is expected to be kind of greater intimacy, or you're not as welcome. And this comes through in a couple of ways. It comes through in terms of the size of the gates, the doorways, so that you have these huge gates on these outer walls, and then you have gates there in this part. So you got these three gates, and so notice how everything is kind of set so that it kind of funnels towards the center here. And so you have the gates coming here, and then you also have elevation taking place. And so to come in, you step up, here you step up, and here you would step up. So you step up 7 steps, and then 8 steps, and then another 10 steps to come into this kind of big house. And the gates get narrower. And so all that is doing is kind of communicating that God really does dwell here. And just like you would expect in any other house, there are places where you got to be intimate in order to be able to go. And so everybody was welcomed in these areas, and then the Levites kind of worked in this area here, preparing sacrifices and everything, and the priests went in this area, and then this Holy of Holies, only the high priest went there once a year. And this back building, it's like that's off limits. That only God goes there. And so we began to get a picture that God actually kind of resided there, didn't just do business there, that they really did see it as a house. And we see this in terms of the elevation changes and the change of the doorways. We'll come back to that. Well, let me just say it here. Maybe our first response to that is to be a little bit offended because we so believe in the priesthood of believers. Why are there certain areas that are kind of off, you know, off limits? And instead of kind of looking at it that way and kind of being offended that God might have places in his house that are off limits to me, maybe to begin to rethink that God really lives here. Like God is in the neighborhood. Like God didn't build his temple, his house, out someplace else, that God is actually in the neighborhood. And maybe there are levels of intimacy, degrees of intimacy with God to where, you know, my relationship can go. But it's not so much that it is totally, you know, I don't know. Rather than being offended, recognize, wow, God's here. He doesn't just show up to do business now and then. The next thing I want us to think about is the storage rooms. So the storage rooms would be this area right here and right over here. So the storage rooms are there, and then the rooms right next to them, just a little bit further out, we read about those in chapter 42. Those are the priestly rooms where the priest would have their meals to celebrate the sacrifices that were made, to honor God, to eat the holy food. Here's the thing I want to get at. They're important, but they're not central. The storage rooms where people's offerings are brought and kept and all of that stuff were, you know, kind of the treasuries of the temple. Important, but it's not central. Where the priests gather to eat their meals. Important, but not central. And so what we see in terms of what is central is that place where the priest would go, that sanctuary, where the priest would go to offer up the prayers of the people. That's what was going on there. You had space that was carved out, set out for prayer, for worship, for listening. That's what was central. And so there's a whole lot of important stuff that happened at the temple in terms of offerings being brought, in terms of the priests doing their jobs, fulfilling their functions. But as important as that stuff was, it wasn't central. What was central was that space that was set up for meeting with God, for being brought into God's presence. And we see this develop more as we kind of look at it and think more about it. Did you notice that there was wood paneling over everything? And I don't know how you feel about wood paneling. I mean, for a while that was really popular, but maybe not so much today. But the wood paneling covered everything. And this wood paneling was decorated, had carved palm trees into it, the carved cherubim into it with the face of the human and the face of the lion. Well, think about it for a moment. What would it feel like if instead of it was paneling, it was marble? Or instead of paneling, it was gold? The thing that comes through with the paneling is that it's warm, that it's okay to touch. If it were simply a marble hallway, it would feel so sterile and so lifeless and so cold. And if it was all gold, it would almost be like, don't touch, just look. But because it's wood, there's a warmth to it. There's kind of a more natural invitingness to it. And then with the cherubim, I know that just sounds a little freaky that you got these angel beings with two faces. But what that would have communicated was a sense of security. a sense of kind of being watched over. That was the work of angels, is to watch over and provide safety and security. And then the palm trees would have been, we talked about this last week, the palm trees would have been symbols of kind of paradise. And so what you have here is that the whole thing has this kind of, if I could say it this way, this garden feel to it. That as you go into God's place, it's warm, it's welcoming, it's garden-like, it's secure. Now, ironically, on the outside, it may look rather stone. But once you're brought on the inside, you discover the wood paneling. You discover the palm trees. You discover the guardian angel, so to speak, watching over. So that's all pretty interesting to me in terms of this kind of garden motif. The doors and the table. So right in the center of that sanctuary, before you go into the Holy of Holies, we saw that there was a table there. And we also saw that there was great emphasis or great attention given to the doors. And so I think the doors are important in terms of invitation. They were open in terms of access. But the doors also communicate that you're a guest here. The doors communicate that this is the Lord's house, but they're open. And so there should be no sense of entitlement. The doors communicate that I'm not entitled to be here, but I'm welcome to be here. And then the table. The purpose of the table is for fellowship. That you share life over the table. And that hospitality is offered over the table. And Ezekiel doesn't say it, but the table that they would have thought about would be the table that kind of hosted the bread of the presence, which would have reminded them how God provided for them in the wilderness. And so as they come to worship, and as we think about kind of the truth of the architecture and the truth of the way it's designed, what we begin to see is a God who really has set up space in God's house to meet with us. That God has set up space within God's house for us to come and for God to listen and for God to give and to care and to sustain. And so it really becomes pretty profound as you think about the architecture and what's being communicated. We also saw it kind of closed off with this wall that's around the compound, and that's how it opened. We heard the dimensions, 10 feet by 10 feet or a rod by a rod. And now we get the dimensions that it's 500 cubits all the way around. And again, we see that the wall is there, you know, not to keep people out. I remind you of the gates. But the wall is there to remind everybody that, hey, this is sacred space. This is kind of God's turf. This is God's house. It's well ordered. It's not chaotic. There's a sense of perfection to it. And what happens in this place is to change the way that life is lived outside this place. That when you go to God's house and you meet with God and you have fellowship together and you worship God and you learn the ways of God and you hear from God, you are in God's house and you experience God's presence and God's blessing, but the gates aren't just for entering, the gates are for also going out. And so you go out differently than you came in, and you go out and live differently for having been in the presence of God. And so the walls kind of mark the place off as, hey, we are going to meet with God. That's God's territory. That's where God lives. But having met with God in God's house, you go out differently. And again, I don't know. It's kind of the difference between the holy and the common. And I'm trying to figure out a way to communicate that well. What if your boss invited you to their house for dinner? Your boss invited you over for dinner, and around the dinner table, you talked about life, you talked about work, you talked about family, you talked about pretty much about everything. And how would that change how you functioned at work? How would that change how you function just when you went back to your house, like the boss had me over for dinner. I mean, wouldn't that begin to affect you a little bit in terms of how you live life outside of the boss's house because you had been to the boss's house? And see, that I think is kind of what's going on here with the walls, that God really is there, that this is sacred space. And God invites us to enter into that sacred space and to worship and to hear and to fellowship and to pray. And then when we go back out, we discover that we start to live differently because we had been there. We had been invited over to the house of God. So I think that's some of the truth that's in the architecture. Now, maybe most important thing, Jesus fulfills it. That Jesus is the temple. In the Gospel of John, when Jesus goes into the temple that did get built in Jerusalem, and he sees all of the buying and the selling that's going on there, and he realizes that they have kind of profaned God's house again, then he tells them, destroy this temple, I will destroy this house and in 3 days rebuild it. And they think he's crazy. How's he going to destroy the temple? I mean, it's not that one, but it's pretty formidable. And then what the disciples later discover is that he was talking about himself. That Jesus is the temple. That Jesus is God's house. That in Jesus, God resides, dwells, moves into the neighborhood, however you want to say it. That the fullness of God came to dwell in Jesus in bodily form, to take up residence amongst us. And so that when we encounter Jesus, when we meet Jesus, in some sense, we are meeting this temple fulfilled. That it's a meeting place with God. That we are invited into this presence with God, this fellowship with God. And so we see Jesus pronouncing forgiveness of sins. We see Jesus comforting people. We see Jesus offering sustenance to people. We see Jesus teaching the ways of God. We see Jesus in intimate settings. We see Jesus having relationship with the Father that we only know he had, but we weren't there. Sometimes Jesus would go off to pray by himself. So again, you can kind of think about that in terms of all access to Jesus. The disciples had a little bit more access to Jesus. Peter, James, and John, they had special access to Jesus. But Jesus also had his back room where he would send them on their way and he would go up on a mountain and he would pray to God. And so we see Jesus fulfilling this, that Jesus is that temple, that reality of God living amongst us. Now, one more thing. The passage in Hebrews that Alex read begins to talk about house in a little bit different way. Not simply that Jesus is the house, but that we, the church, are the house. And so then we have to kind of begin to think, okay, how is this reality to be fulfilled amongst us? So that as a people, not as a building, but as a people, God makes God's dwelling, abiding place amongst us. That we really become God's house. So that we as a people are kind of covered with wood paneling. Instead of maybe just being, stark marble. That we're covered with wood paneling as a people that is warm, that is inviting. That as a wood paneling, there's a palm tree. There should be something kind of garden-esque about us. Where there is restoration, where there is renewal, where there is recovery. There should be a sense of angels watching over. That when I'm amongst those people, they call themselves the church, the house of God, there is a sense of security, a sense of peace. And granted, it may not always look like it from the outside. That Jesus could be pretty harsh with Pharisees, with self-righteous people, with kind of powers that be. He could be pretty stark. But when you let go of that and you actually accepted the invitation to come in, you discovered a warmth and a welcome and a table and life. And so to begin to think about, in what way do we fulfill kind of the truth of the architecture, the truth of God abiding? And even we, you know, we're pretty low church, but even we recognize that there are places that not just anybody goes. And I don't know if you've thought about that, but in the Church of the Nazarene, only the ordained or the district licensed serve communion. It's kind of a place that not everybody has access to, that everybody goes. The pulpit is kind of that way. And so to realize that, yeah, we do kind of live this out, fulfill this in various kinds of ways. But that kind of truth that God actually dwells amongst us. As I've been looking at the architecture, I can't help but think about what we're doing in terms of sending Chris and Rachel and the team to plant a church in East Village. That we're not sending them there just to kind of do the restaurant thing, the dining room thing on the perimeter. That's not the center of what they're going there for. The center of what they're going there for is prayer, worship, proclamation. And that stuff is going to happen on the perimeter, but at the central, it's going to be meeting with God. That, hey, we are a people where you can come and you can meet with God, that God dwells amongst us. And so in some sense, to begin to think about not simply, I don't know, that what is being planted is God's house. What's being planted is a house of God, to where God resides amongst Chris and Rachel and all of the team that's there. And whether they end up meeting on the sixth or seventh floor of the library, whether the Lord has a different place for them to meet, but that there's a house there, a people there, that when others come and kind of pass through their gates, they're not just receiving kind of a meal on the outside or, you know, that, but they're actually being brought into conversation with God and being invited to lift their lives up to God and to receive the life that God has for them. What I would propose, given that this is the season of Lent starting Wednesday, I'd like to challenge you to do two things. So first thing, just as that meeting space with God is central to kind of the whole temple complex, I would challenge each of you, myself included, to make sure that we have central space in our lives for meeting with God. Central space for praying, central space for listening. We have a lot of important things that we do in our lives. But if I get the truth of the architecture, there is nothing more central, nothing more important than having meeting space in my life with God. And so I would challenge you, challenge myself, that between now and Easter, this season of Lent, that we make sure, whether we have to carve out, clear out, expand, whatever we have to do, that we're actually building and creating meeting space in our lives, in our schedules, for God. That we clear out some temple space. So that's the first thing I would challenge you to do. And the second thing I would challenge you to do is to pray about helping fund this downtown temple, this East Village temple. So that between now and Easter, you are praying about, God, how would you have me give towards this? Because this is a worthy thing. There needs to be a temple there. There needs to be a people there. And I know that there's other churches there and other temples there, but our sense is that there needs to be one more, at least. And so What part would God have you, what part would God have me to give towards that, to fund that? Easter Sunday is Sending Sunday. That on Easter Sunday, as we celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ, we are also going to be sending Chris and Rachel and the team to East Village that day. And after Easter Sunday, they won't be meeting with us except on special occasions where we come together to celebrate. That beginning with the Sunday after Easter, they start meeting in East Village. And we don't know where yet. We have some ideas where we would like, but we don't know where yet. But we are trusting that just as we are kind of God's temple, God's house on this corner, so God has a corner, a floor, someplace for them to be God's house there. And so I would challenge you to pray about, okay, how can I contribute to that, Lord? What would you have me give towards that? That's part of our part to play, is giving towards the planting of the temple down there in East Village as much as here. So that's kind of my Lenten challenge to you. And I kind of see it through the theology of the architecture, the truth of the architecture, that one, we need to make sure we have space in our lives, space in our services, and then to help fund Chris and Rachel and the team in terms of creating space there for meeting with God. Well, I invite you to stand with me and to come and to receive communion. You might say it this way: we become the temple as we receive the temple. We become the abode of God as we receive the gift of God, His Son. And so I invite you to come and to receive the bread, receive the cup, return to your seats. We'll take communion together. And Rebecca and the band, if you guys would come and sing the third song that you did at the beginning, I think, Rain in Us. Rain in Us.